We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you from the terrible secret of space. Terrible secrets of space. You know, I'm expecting by like episode 25, we'll actually be able to say things in sync, or we will actually just go to the same location and film in physical proximity.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
That would be kind of nice. Anyway, that has nothing to do with our topic tonight, so we don't have a good segue. We're going to be talking about space habitats and some things about space habitats and why space habitats are cool and what we could do with space habitats and space is cool.
You get the idea. We're going to talk about space stations and such, both past, present, and future. It's going to be a good time, so hang on tight.
People living in space intentionally or unintentionally. I don't think anybody's lived in space unintentionally.
It's got to be really hard to live in space unintentionally, because it's like it's an expensive endeavor getting up there. I digress.
You just wake up one morning, you're just like, I'm gonna go out to get the bacon and eggs, and you're in space.
It's like that boy. You know how Boy Scouts, you know, they'd like put your mattress out in the river, well, at space camp, you fall asleep, and then he's like, "Hey guys, dude, Rich just fell asleep. Let's put him on the top of an Atlas V, and we're gonna launch him in LEO." Yeah.
He'll never expect it. What a tard. Okay. So, space habitats, and by that we're of course talking about space stations. People have lived in space before space stations for short periods of time, and with that we're talking about the Apollo program and previous programs and the lunar landings in particular. That's going to be on next week's episode where we talk about ground-based space habitats. So this week and next week will kind of tie into each other on that common point of realistic outlooks on humans living in space.
Absolutely.
But I digress. Space habitats, starting with, as far as I know, the Salyut program from Russia, and by the same token, the Almaz program, which is Salyut plus guns.
Yep, Salyut plus guns, the Russian military. Because what's more interesting, I mean, honestly, than spacecraft? And then you put weapons on them. I mean, there's really only one way you can upgrade something in space, and it's to throw something that goes pew-pew on it.
Basically.
For better or for worse.
And I mean, who doesn't want that? So, the Salyut program began around 1971, and that is honestly not all that far away from, you know, humanity's first trips into space. So we made some pretty great strides in just, what, under a decade?
Just about. I mean, shoot, that whole period in time. We went to the moon in 1969. Before that, we were all just gearing up to go to the moon. So, I mean, when was Gagarin's flight? I know I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible person right now for not knowing when the first flight into space was. I believe it was 1961.
I was just going to let you sit in shame. It's fine.
Yes, 1961, April 12th, I think. That's when Yuri's night is, April 12th.
Yep.
For the unindoctrinated, it is the, you know, the worldwide space party that everyone can do April 12th every year. Space.
Which makes it a good party.
Yes.
So anyway, the Salyut and Almaz programs consisted of several stations. The Salyut ones were more civilian and research-based, so they would conduct a few scientific experiments along those lines. And I believe we went all the way through Salyut 7 before the program was terminated and replaced with, later on, Mir and other space stations. And of those, Salyut 2, 3, and 5 were all of the Almaz designation ones, which is basically the same except for a 23mm Richter cannon attached to the front of it, which is kind of boss, honestly. I'm not 100% sure what they were trying to what they thought they would shoot with it. Were they planning on shooting the ground? I honestly don't know.
No, it was more of a defensive weapon. They were afraid that the United States would attack their space stations and try to commandeer them. And so they put those out there to, you know, kind of deter that. But, I mean, it's not like the gun could move anywhere, so to actually be you know, a viable defense of sorts, you had to rotate the entire station, which would use up a big chunk of your, you know, stabilization fuel. So, like most of that kind of thing, great idea and concept, but not so good in practicality. But you got to give them the effort for trying, right? Because it's still pretty cool.
I kind of, other than the fact that it would have caused probably an international conflict that would have resulted in the nuclear devastation of our planet, commandeering a space station would have been a pretty cool thing to have read about in our history books.
Space piracy.
Yeah, seriously. First known case of space piracy would have been an amazing feat for the country to undertake, but I digress. That probably would have caused more problems than it would have solved.
Yes. You really can't solve a lot with piracy.
So, moving on from the Salyut and Almaz programs, which were basically use and forget, like shoot and forget stations, is they would bring them up all in one solid piece and assemble them, you know, any minor assembly, extending the solar panels, that sort of thing. And then they would send up the crew. The crew would stay on the station for the duration of the mission, and then they would get in their little Soyuz lander or whatever they were using at the time, and they would come back down and leave, and the station would just be deorbited. And I believe they've finished deorbiting all of them shortly after the program completed to, you know, free up the space in our very meticulously clear skies above, which is totally full of garbage and rocket
Speaking
parts.
Speaking of meticulously clear skies, I got to put it out there because, holy smokes, we just kind of ran into this, stumbled across it this evening. Stuff in Space, or Stuff in Dot Space, is a website where you can go and watch a real-life sky track of all the junk that's in space, and that's stuff in one word, S-T-U-F-F-I-N dot space. Check it out. You will. It'll definitely be worth your time there.
We got to give a shout-out to James Yoder, I believe is how you pronounce him. He's the one who designed this site.
Yes.
And we just stumbled across this tonight while we were discussing what we were going to, the finer points, at least what we were going to talk about on the episode. And we delayed this whole recording about half an hour because we were just going around and clicking on all the things going, oh, look at this, look at this, look at this. So it's definitely one of those kind of websites that you, if you're really interested in that, you could probably spend like an hour on that just checking out what is above you currently and then Googling its designation to see exactly what it is and if you should be afraid of it.
Yeah.
Which 9 times out of 10 is no, but anyway, so the Salyut and Almaz stations have been taken care of. They're all done. They only had enough supplies to last for the duration of their mission. After that, they, and by they I mean the Soviet Union, decided to launch a more progressive space program, which was the Mir space station, which is kind of like the, I'm going to call it the testing grounds for what the International Space Station eventually became. Because Mir was designed to be a more long-term habitat with the ability to expand, just like the International Space Station does, not to just be a one-time up and then done. Like, you could resupply it and restock it and put on additional laboratories. And there was this sense of international cooperation with it, although at a reduced scope due to the fact the Cold War was still ongoing for much of its life until the Soviet Union collapsed, but Mir survived for another several years past that.
It did. It did indeed. Mir lasted up until right around, I think they finally deorbited that thing just at the turn of the century in 2001.
Yeah, it lasted for a long time, and in fact, it overlaps the International Space Station, which we'll talk about in a second, because that has been occupied since November of 2000, so it was up slightly before that. But looking at Mir versus the International Space Station, you see a lot of design parallels and places where they've sincerely improved on the concept of space habitats. And Mir is definitely one of those long stories of where things go south real fast and everybody is good and then a fire breaks out and everybody's freaking out. And we've learned a lot from our human experience in that first major space station.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mir had quite a history with things running into it. You know, you had debris incidents where stuff would break off of Mir and because stuff would hit it. You had fires on board the station, and a fire in space is never a good thing, especially in an oxygenated environment. I mean, look what happened to Apollo 1, for example. rest their souls. But it was a tremendous undertaking, and I have to say, Mir was in a, you know, it looks like a giant hobbled together piece of junk in space, but it really was pretty beautiful. And to think that we put something up like that just in 1986, not too shabby.
No. So at the same time that Mir was going on, or around the same time, actually, I guess it was quite a bit.
It was earlier.
It was earlier, wasn't it? Was the United States basically answer to the Salyut and Almaz project, which was Skylab, which I, without having a frame of reference, when I was a kid back in the 90s, I had thought that that was totally something we were still doing because that's what they were talking about in the 90s, because that was the United States, you know, big hurrah for space at that juncture. So Skylab was basically our one and done station where we sent it up, had crew members living in it for several turns. They were able to resupply it better than the Almaz projects or the Salyut and Almaz.
It was actually designed by Wernher von Braun, conceptually designed by Wernher von Braun for using the upper stage of the Saturn V as a space station. So instead of boosting you into a translunar injection to go land on the moon, the upper stage now would become your space station. And it was a pretty hefty stage, let me tell you about that. It was, I think it's like 33 feet across, this thing, in diameter. So not a small piece up there.
Nice.
But it's certainly not like what Mir was. But this did predate Mir by about a decade.
Yeah, give and or take. So Skylab was our, and by our I mean the United States' big kick during the earlier days of space to get a habitable human settlement in space. And it certainly served its purpose. We learned a lot of lessons from that as well. And that brings us on to our current space habitation, International Space Habitation, which is the International Space Station, which has, again, been up there since a little bit before 2000, and we've been habitating it since November of 2000. And that is still a constantly ongoing project with new modules going up, I'm going to say all the time. I mean, it's, you know, months and or years between new, completely functional additional modules, but there's still room for expansion on this station. And you can look at videos, and I highly encourage you to do this, of course, is to go and look at some of the videos that crew members of the station have filmed while they were on their tours of duty there for their 3 or 6 months durations, depending on the mission. And I mean, it's literally like a freaking crawl space, and it's amazing that once you have to stop conceptualizing your environment by a floor and walls and a ceiling where everything is a table, basically, and you're just crawling through a tunnel of infinite tables on every surface, that like a crawl space makes total sense for how everything would work. I don't know. I get super tickled by that.
Indeed, in space, everything is your countertop. There are no walls.
Yeah.
Everything is the ceiling and everything is the floor all at one time. But you put it in perspective, too. And the ISS has been freaking, it's been great. So, you know, Skylab, like the first space station that was long duration. I mean, the Salyut Almaz stations lasted a couple years here and there. Skylab lasted about 6 years in orbit. Mir was 15 years, which marks since the International Space Station was launched, you know, just before the 2000. We've been up there since the year 2000. It's just been about 15 years. So International Space Station is just about to break Mir's duration record as far as being in space.
Wow.
Which is nothing to shake a stick at.
No, not at all.
A decade and a half, this thing has been up there in space. And it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, seriously, it's an ongoing project, and I, as with everything on this almost everything on this program, I of course encourage everybody to keep track of events happening on there. We're currently, the big news is we have an astronaut, two astronauts actually, one from America, one from Russia, doing a year in space, which is going to give us a lot of the information that we need in order to move forward with the space program, in the sense that a mission to Mars is going to be a multi-year process of actually traveling, being there, and then getting back to Earth in any realistic, you know, with current propulsion technology, unless somebody actually comes through with a space folding drive or something that renders the trip somewhat shorter. But with current chemical propulsion or ion propulsion or whatever we happen to equip these vessels with, we need to understand how humans are going to survive in a microgravity or no gravity environment for over a couple of years without going, you know, totally to mush, as humans are wont to do.
Yeah. Human factors, and we'll get into this in a later series, I'm almost certain of it. Human factors is the major limiting factor right now on our ability to go into space. It's not really how much technology we can throw at the problem right now, because we just honestly don't understand all of the quirks about the human body and how it operates in a zero-gravity environment.
Yeah, and that brings us to the next section we wanted to talk about, which is the challenges of living in a space-borne environment, because of everything, humans are definitely not well-equipped to deal with a gravityless vacuum.
Yes.
That is like the opposite of what we are designed to deal with.
First and foremost, as I was pondering over my breakfast this morning, I wondered to myself of a very, very, very serious problem for zero gravity, and that is pancakes. How do you make pancakes in space? Think about that for a second. No, but seriously, there's a lot of a larger issues at stake besides making pancakes, although I do consider that one pretty up there. I'm still thinking about it. Yeah, think about that for a second. How would you make a pancake work in space?
Okay, what if the pan... the pan itself is the heating coil. So you've got the pan itself is hot, and you are constantly moving the pan, you know, around, so it's got the acceleration is into the surface of the pan, and then you could just pour your batter and start whipping it around as it cooked. And
so
then
pancake centrifuge?
Yeah, and so then to flip it, you just stop it, and the pancake keeps going, and then you whip the pan around to the other side, and you flip the pan, you know? I think we could do that.
Oh, yes.
Maybe we should ask NASA. Maybe they would consent to do that.
We'll get some funding from the government to make a pancake machine for the ISS. It'll be the flapjack module.
Okay. I think that's a worthy scientific endeavor.
You heard it here first, folks. The flapjack module.
Yep.
Coming to a space station near you.
It's going up there next to subatomic spaghetti.
You know, waffles would be a lot easier to make because you could just use a waffle iron and then inject it like you know, mold inject plastic.
Anyway.
But anyway, goodness gracious me. Well, what do you do with food? Water, oxygen, carbon dioxide, you know, the things that we inhale, eat, expirate, and whatnot on a daily basis.
Yeah, so we'll hop at them one at a time. Water is not necessarily a huge problem, depending on your circumstance, because water is easy to make if you have elemental hydrogen and elemental oxygen, or a way to make those elements from what you have, which in some cases is just a matter of either harvesting them from some resource and having enough energy to combine them or break apart, you know, whatever you're getting it from. So water is sometimes okay, sometimes not. It depends on where you are. Around the Earth, it's definitely going to be more of a shipment from Earth necessity is the easiest.
Absolutely.
Oxygen and carbon dioxide are also more of a ship from Earth kind of necessity in a long-term space flight, unless we get the ability to completely recombine carbon dioxide into oxygen, which there are some potentials for technologies that will allow us to do so given enough energy. Currently, I think the best thing that we know about is plants, because that's what they were designed to do.
Yep. And algae, I think of plants is giving us the best the best ratio as far as weight to oxygen carbon dioxide conversion at the moment.
So it could be that unless current technology advances, the first long-term space travel mission will have a significant portion of the interior modules covered in algae or some kind of hyper-dense algae storage that you run your recycled air through and constantly have to prune. I'm not sure. If it's edible algae, then I guess you could eat it. That would kind of help the food problem.
Yum, yum.
Yeah, delicious algae.
Freaking algae, man, getting a free ride into space. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Not that algae dream. Maybe algae just dream about going to space.
It could. If I was algae, I'd dream about space. Mm-hmm. You know, as I do.
should make a short film about the LG astronaut.
Yep. So, and that is, of course, part of the food problem. We're in need of carbs for cheap and vitamins to sustain us. So, in some cases, a well-rationed nutrition diet can help bring the food cost as far as volume and weight down to a manageable level, but that's still a lot of eatery supplies to take between planets for a space-based civilization or habitat, as it were.
Yep. And on the way there, I mean, you really don't have enough time to grow your own food, if that were an option, and we could do that. And we have, you know, we have grown food on the International Space Station. We're reading recently they made some lettuce and had the first space-grown salad in space.
Yep, space salad.
Which is, you know, pretty mundane when you compare it to, like, you know, just your normal lunch on Earth. But when you think about it, you know, the endeavor that goes into growing and sustaining an organism in space that was not designed for that, and then it actually working, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and one thing that is important to remember with any kind of microgravity environment, and microgravity plays hell with humans, we'll talk about that in a second, but everything that we know on Earth was designed to survive and flourish in a gravity-filled environment. So a lot of the way that an organism grows is super dependent on it being like, okay, this is down, that's up, everything else is, you know, side to side, that kind of thing. So I need to grow up, or I need to grow out, or something. And we've seen a lot of experiments with tadpoles evolving into frogs in a microgravity environment, and they just kind of like sprout limbs all over the frickin' place because they've got no concept of, like, their biology has no concept of which way is down, because in space, every way is down. So it's kind of just following the crowd. And so when you're dealing with growing food crops and sustainable ecology in space, you have to really wonder about how well things that we take for granted on Earth looking or reacting a certain way is actually going to happen in an environment where you don't actually have an up.
Yes.
Or you have infinite ups, I guess. It depends on how you look at it.
Yeah, is it zero or is it infinity? Who knows?
Yep.
That sounds like a mathematical problem.
Oh, I don't do math.
Yeah, no.
We don't need math. And even on human tissue, microgravity is an issue simply because all of the ways that our muscles grow and that our bones calcify, those were all designed to support our weight underneath about 14 pounds of atmosphere, give or take, depending on where you are on the Earth's surface. And it also has to deal with us constantly exerting effort to get out of bed and to move around and to, you know, walk from your computer to your fridge and then back to your computer and then to your bed and then back to your computer and then to your fridge, you know, the three most important places. And so in space, we atrophy like crazy and we turn into little space skeletons of humans.
Yeah, it's chilling.
You're just sitting there going, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I got a little bit sidetracked. As I was thinking about this, I had remembered when we were talking about Soyuz. So Salyut 1, as we were talking about the Salyut Alamos systems earlier, Soyuz 11 was the first manned mission to try to board that first space station, Salyut 1.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a disaster, and I had forgotten that the crew capsule depressurized during the reentry, and the entire three-man crew died.
Oh.
And I was just like, it's chilling to think. But those were the three astronauts, or cosmonauts in that case, to have died outside of the Earth's atmosphere. Granted, you know, we have Challenger and Columbia, but both of those...
they exploded within our atmosphere.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and
space is a harsh place.
Yeah. Technically, you could call the space station currently residing inside of a part of our atmosphere, but for all intents and purposes of the survivable troposphere, we can call it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much.
Absolutely. And then radiation, too. Let's not forget. I mean, that was, wow, what a segue. Radiation. Yeah. Non-existent segue. What?
There we go.
Radiation, man, is going to get you. And not just because it's out there creeping around like a stealthy assassin. But, you know, we have instances where the sun kind of just goes crazy. Wow, that's a technical term right there for you. Where the sun will, you know, eject plasma into space. And, you know, it'll knock out electrical systems on satellites. Well, if that hits you up in space and you're outside of the Earth's gravity field, goodness, no, the magnetic field, you are not going to be protected at all from that. And you're going to French fry inside from the inside out. And, you know, you have examples, maybe not perfect examples of what happens to humans when they're exposed to high levels of radiation. But like on K-19, the Widowmaker, where the Russian submarine had an incident with their reactor and a bunch of dudes got some serious radiation overdoses. I think they're up in the thousands of rads, which is a fatal dose. And golly, we don't have a viable method of taking care of that yet. So that's why most of our manned spaceflight has been within low Earth orbit. That and also because of the expense in sending something beyond that. I mean, once you're in LEO, you've heard it once, you'll hear it a million times. Low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. So it takes half as much energy to get you into low Earth orbit as anywhere else in this, pretty much in the solar system. You know, within, say, Mars. Well, you can send stuff out, but I digress.
Yeah. Hey, getting things going fast is not usually a problem. Getting them to slow down from being fast is usually the problem, but that's probably a topic for a different episode, especially since we're running short on time here. So with that in mind, the last few things we want to talk about is the hypothetical future of space habitats, and a lot of concepts have come through over the years, some of them more believable than others, depending on how you look at it, like a giant brick moon in space. Thank you, 1800s. A lot of different space habitats ideas have come through, and three of them, which are essentially the exact same idea, that seem to be the most promising, at least from a... Okay, well, not exactly promising. Depends on how you look at the sustainability versus how much resources and money it would take to make one of these. But a Bernal Sphere, a Sanford Torus, and an O'Neill Cylinder, which are basically large rotating objects, and you live on the inside surface of said rotating objects.
Yep. Huge. We're talking like 20, 40 kilometers in size here, folks.
Yeah.
These are big things.
So the most frequently shown one is an O'Neill Cylinder, and that is basically, imagine a cylinder in space. You could probably have already gotten the cylinder part from the name. It is rotating around its central axis, and humans are living on the inside curved surface of the cylinder. And ideally, it would be divided into six segments. The alternating three would be windows. The other alternating three would be land areas. That way you would get sunlight coming in for... night would be basically the time when your segment would be blocking the sun for the other two segments. That kind of thing. Well, I guess you get night in like three chunks per day. That'd be kind of weird, actually, now that I think about it.
You got bigger issues, though, with Bernal's or O'Neill Cylinder. We got to get that to work. But yeah, that would be a strange thing.
Yeah, so the reason why these ones are seemingly good is for a variety of reasons. The size of these constructs is designed to make it, you know, one, a very easy to habitate area, because you would basically have the same kind of structure of there's a lot of land, so people can kind of spread out and have their own communities. If it was tightly packed, you'd have something that looked like a giant city inside of a cylinder, which I think Mass Effect already did, but go figure. So you have the benefit of having a lot of land, and by the virtue of having a lot of volume, that means that once it's pressurized with oxygen, even in the case of a catastrophic, like a meteor goes through the window of it and punches a couple of holes, it's going to take a while for that air to drain out. So you have a lot of time, comparatively at least, to go and seal the breach using whatever means. And I mean, if we're building something like that, we've probably got some pretty beefy service ships or something that we can use to seal the breaches. So it's very survivable of catastrophic failures in that sense. Also, it uses the centripetal acceleration or centrifugal force, depending on who you talk to and how many years of physics they've taken, because I've been yelled at both ways. It uses that to keep you rooted to the inside of the cylinder. That way we avoid the whole microgravity problem that we were talking about earlier, because now you have this, and it doesn't have to be spinning all that fast either for you to get a good 9.8 meters per second squared of acceleration, or at least something close enough to that where we don't really care. And let's be honest, we've all wanted to jump like 12 feet in the air because gravity could just be, you know, a little bit less than it is right now, and it probably wouldn't matter all that much. Mm-hmm. But you've got that problem solved as well because of the centripetal acceleration.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, quite honestly, the easiest way to deal with a lot of the human factors in space is just to hack gravity in some fashion. I mean, even a 0.25 Gs would be freaking awesome. And that's kind of more of like what's like on the moon.
So definitely a few good options for going towards the future. I actually want to look up real quick how fast the cylinder needs to rotate, because I was just thinking about something about...
While he's thinking about something.
Yeah, I'm thinking about something.
An interesting idea for how to make said substructure. Because you're like, oh, dang, I got all this stuff, got to put stuff in space. Well, how do I do that? Space resources, folks. Space resources. Got you have your asteroids in space, right? That's my favorite thing to talk about. But for an O'Neill cylinder, something similar to it, an idea was proposed that you would take a nickel and iron asteroid. You'd go and find it. You'd get a giant freaking mirror in space, of course. And you're going to use the sun to bore a hole through the center of it. You're going to put a cap on one end. And you're going to fill it with some water. So now you've got this hole that you've burned a hole through with this mirror, right? Got some water in there. And you're going to heat it up until it turns into steam. And you're going to go ahead and keep heating this thing up while you're starting to spin it. And so you get this, and this, to me, reminds me a lot of when you're blowing glass. And I know, and I realize that a lot of people haven't done glass blowing, but you put a little bubble in this blob of molten glass, which in this case is a blob of molten asteroid. And as you spin it, the gas and or water in this example expands, or steam is a gas, so that works. Expands, putting force on the inside, and so as you spin it, it expands. And the walls thin out, and this structure gets larger. And so the idea to use that that effect for a space station was you take a 1 kilometer sized asteroid, and you then expand it into a 20 kilometer sized asteroid. Obviously, the walls are much, much thinner now, but you've got yourself a giant bubble of metal, essentially, is the way you think of it. Now, granted, that idea, I believe, was conceived in the late 70s, early 80s, and we really didn't have a large grasp of how asteroids were structured and what their mineralogy content was. Not that we have a big big advantage on that now. We certainly have learned a lot, but we are we don't know as much as we should, essentially. Hopefully, we're working on that, but yeah.
Okay, so I checked it out. It was figuring out to be about 40 times an hour to simulate Earth gravity, which is pretty darn fast, faster than I was thinking it would need to rotate. But what I was thinking is, how cool would it be that, so the station is rotating in a certain direction along the axis, so you get in your car and you drive in the opposite direction of rotation. Eventually, if you drive fast enough, your velocity cancels out the velocity imparted to you by the rotation of the cylinder, and then all of a sudden your car is no longer being held in the same reference frame, right? So it starts to float because it's no longer benefiting from that centripetal acceleration that's holding it to the floor. Is that right? I don't know if that's right. I hope we should ask Mauser. He probably knows.
Physicist, yes.
Because I want to do that. I want to drive a car so fast it lifts off into the, you know, into the sunset, which,
oh
of
goodness.
Course, is a window, and then you blast through the window, but it takes a while for the air to escape, so everybody else is fine.
There you go.
Okay. We'll ask Mauser. We'll tell you. I'll make it a point. We'll tell you guys next time what he thinks, because he probably knows.
He has opinions on this, I'm sure. He's probably listening to this right now, thinking to himself, these guys are very silly. I don't know what they're talking about. If only I was there.
I'll just bug him after I put this episode up and go, huh? Okay. Well, I think that about wraps it for Space Environments. Look forward next week to hearing about stationary lands in space environments. Or ground bases, if you want to be boring.
Talking about colonization, folks.
Yep.
Colonization of space. The future.
Of things in space. Not just space, maybe space and stuff. I don't know. It'll be pretty good. Well.
It's going to be great. You should definitely listen to it.
It's going
to
be real great.
If you survived through listening to this entire podcast, the next one is going to be wonderful.
Indeed. Until that time, ladies and gentlemen, I'm the Pusher Robot.
And I am Sir Server Robot.
And you have gone down the stairs. About that space, about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, about that space.